Lawmakers in over 30 states have proposed laws to ban transgender athletes from participating in school sports. Idaho legislators passed the first law of this kind in 2020, but that law's blocked for now after the American Civil Liberties Union sued the state. Recently, the governor of Florida signed a law specifically banning trans girls from sports. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about the issue with an expert on transgender medicine. Today, we're going to talk to the authors of the new book, Disrupting Dignity, Rethinking Power and Progress in LGBTQ Lives. Dr. Stephen Engel is a professor of politics at Bates College in Lewiston, Maine, where he teaches constitutional law and LGBTQ politics. Dr. Timothy Lyle is an assistant professor of English and cultural studies at Iona College in New Rochelle, New York. I started with Dr. Lyle asking why they approached LGBTQ issues from a starting point of dignity.
I think it gave us a good opportunity to combine our interests and our expertise. We noticed in talking to each other and talking to colleagues in different disciplines that dignity is sort of having a moment right now in public health and in cultural representation and the law. It's kind of become a cornerstone for gay rights victories. And so, people, when they normally think of this word, they think of it as sort of a unquestioned good. Who doesn't want to be dignified or have their dignity honored? And we wanted to open up that conversation a little bit, kind of turn it on its head and think about maybe dignity as having a sort of underbelly. So that's kind of where our title comes from. We are trying to kind of disrupt really kind of conventional notions of the word. And we wanted to see how it might function as a boundary making tool rather than something that we should just unquestionably embrace.
Because Timothy and I come from such different disciplinary areas, we found this kind of common thread running through everything we were looking at, which is that dignity itself, while Timothy suggests we tend to think of it as a good thing, we tend to think of it as a fundamental good, that in fact, across these fields, it doesn't necessarily have stable meaning. Right? It's deployed by different people to mean different things at different times. So the meaning can be highly contextual. And that kind of flexibility makes dignity, we argue, a very powerful tool for those in charge. It can be used by governing officials, by politicians, by judges, by creators of culture to draw lines as to who counts and who doesn't, who's valued and who isn't, who's part of the political family and who remains outside of it. And I think importantly, what we end up discussing is how dignity can be used to normalize and naturalize certain ways of being in the world, and then thereby mark other perspectives, behaviors, practices as illegible at best or even dangerous at worst.
Can dignity equal rights?
I think it can, or I think that's how it has been used. So let me lean into a little bit of my area in law and politics, right? We tend to think of dignity most often as a status, right? As something we have that demands respect for our autonomy or individual freedom. To have dignity then is to have one's choices respected, right? But I think that respect can be a slippery term. And I guess here's what I mean by that. In some Supreme Court decisions where there have been a slew of gay rights victories in the last two decades, those decisions by the court often utilize dignity to make clear that the Constitution requires that I respect your choice, even as I might disagree with it. That's the basis for decriminalization of same-sex intimacy. But sometimes the court uses dignity to mean something else entirely. And this has been pointed out by a couple of legal scholars when we look at the marriage equality decisions. In those decisions, the Supreme Court invokes dignity to mean respectability, or the idea that dignity is a status that a person earns or is invested in with for behavior that other people consider worthy. So here, dignity might mean a standard that one should live up to. But crucially, to have dignity in this sense is to behave in a way that conforms to what others value, by which I mean to be respectable. And certainly that's not respect for individual choices. That might in fact be its opposite.
And you do, in one portion of the book, ask the question, is dignity a dead end? How did you get to that? How did you get to that question?
Yeah, so I think that points to the idea that particularly a dead end for jurisprudence. And here, I think we're a little bit skeptical of how dignity has been primarily used by the Supreme Court. And we make essentially three arguments. First, the court has muddled the term. Sometimes it uses it as dignity as respect, other times dignity as respectability. And then dignity has often been used to ground rights claims that are in fact antithetical to LGBTQ rights, and certainly to support conservative outcomes that progressives who support LGBTQ rights might be more concerned with. Here I'm thinking of how dignity has been used to curb abortion access, and how dignity has been used to limit racial equity in access to education.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Steve is right. I mean, we're primarily thinking about the dead end piece of it from the constitutional law perspective, but from a cultural representation perspective as well, I think we would be wise to ask ourselves if the route we've taken to achieve visibility is an inclusive one and is one that promotes equity and one that promotes the kind of queer particularity that we deserve to see on our screens and in our ears and, you know, wherever else we consume media. So when we're asking, you know, is dignity, you know, always a kind of unquestioned good from the area of representation, we're really thinking about visibility as also being a kind of trap, right? Being visible and being recognized according to whose narrative, right? And on whose terms and what kind of worldviews are promoted and what kind of equity is practiced, you know, across the media landscape. And we turn to particular texts like FX's new series Pose as a kind of departure from the more conventional use of dignity as restraint, and sort of try to argue that they are mapping out a new pathway, or at least pivoting a bit towards a more equitable and inclusive representation that isn't necessarily defined by dignity's limits.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I had on the program an expert in transgender medicine, and we spoke about some of the laws that are going around to, targeting school children right now. And I want to talk to you from your perspective on this. Have trans athletes in school become the new boogeyman?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that we're seeing some really unfortunate and revealing seas or waves of legislation, right? Some of them having to do with transgender folks in sports, some having to do with access to healthcare, some having to do with LGBT curriculum in schools, and certainly we, I think, can see. I study language and rhetoric, so I'm interested in this from a language perspective. We see some of the very same terminology and the very same narrative threads being invoked in the sports conversation as we saw in the bathroom conversation. There's, you know, always this kind of invocation of danger and, you know, the child under threat. And, you know, of course, statistically, none of these narratives actually bear out in fact, but they're really powerfully rhetorically. And unfortunately, the consequences are usually paid by the most vulnerable kids among us, even though I would point out that I think it harms all children, right? These policies are harming kids across gender and sexuality spectrums.
I guess what I might add to that is that in our book, we explore how dignity has been conventionally used by all sorts of authorities and power. And one of the ways that it's been used is that to be dignified is to map onto norms and behaviors that more often than not are closest to majoritarian practices. So practices that would align with cisgender, white, and masculinist norms. And in that sense, right, what happens in the chase for dignity is that too often members of our communities that embrace ways of being, embrace practices, and live their fullest lives in ways that are most marginalized often are marked as being undignified, right? And that kind of boundary making we find to be really troubling. And I guess my worry is that this new boundary making in these laws that exclude transgender children and young adults from playing in sports are doing that kind of really deeply harmful boundary making.
Since most of these laws are coming from outside of the school, are the schools themselves equipped to deal with the consequences?
I don't think so, right? I kind of come at this conversation is, and just having lots of casual conversations with trans folks and in my own communities and folks in education is, you know, a lot of these bills, I mean, we should take them very seriously, but a lot of them are dying in committee or they're not sort of, you know, coming to full fruition, even though they absolutely could. But the thing that I think about most often when I'm watching these hearings and I'm reading these headlines is the impact that it's having on kids, the impact that it's having on trans folks to see their very humanity being legislated, right? And being fought over and being questioned and being scrutinized. And so I think one of the big challenges that schools have is promoting the social and emotional well-being of their students in the face of all of these policies. And to that end, I don't know that all of them have the resources, have the staff, have the time, particularly in this era of COVID where education has sort of been completely turned on its head. It's really messy and dangerous. And to your point, is often coming from, you know, completely outside the realm of education. Oftentimes the folks who are weighing in have very little expertise in the actual fields that they're wanting to legislate over.
And if I can put on my like political science hat just for a little bit, I tend to see these as efforts by often conservatives in power to figure out how to mobilize electoral support, right? So what these are doing is this is sort of the latest iteration of a very similar pattern when we saw, say, in the early aughts, referenda to ban same-sex marriage, right? So it's a way to generate a base. It's a way to create a concept of fear, of change, of a boogeyman of change that would potentially mobilize a certain cadre of voters. But I would also argue that one of the things that this represents, and I would point to the situation in Florida with Governor DeSantis, when Governor DeSantis signed the bill into law, he did so, I believe, at a Christian school, not at a public Florida school. And I think what that symbolizes is some of the coming struggles that's going to pit LGBTQ rights claims against religious-based claims grounded in the First Amendment. We saw a little bit of that in 2018 with the Masterpiece Cake Shop decision, which I don't think substantively answered how we would resolve that clash between First Amendment and 14th Amendment claims. And we're likely to see it again this month in the decision coming out of Philadelphia regarding state support for adoption agencies.
It's interesting. I also was thinking of the mid-aughts marriage equality referenda. That was the boogeyman then. A few years ago, it was the bathroom bill. Now we have this. Look ahead. What's coming? What do we have to look forward to?
Yeah, I think on the legal front, we might look forward to ongoing clashes between First Amendment religious expression claims and 14th Amendment claims to due process and equal protection. Here, you know, as I mentioned, the Masterpiece Cake Shop position, Justice Kennedy's decision for the majority kind of punted on the substantive question at issue. But also in last year, Justice Gorsuch, speaking for the majority in the Bostock versus Clayton County decision, lays out, and I think the sort of second to last page of his decision, lays out the entire playbook for how individuals aggrieved from a First Amendment religious expression position could challenge some laws that seek to elevate or just recognize the equality of the LGBTQ community.
Given what you know about the history, and from reading this book, you know a lot about the history. Are we going in the right direction? Have we stalled? What's coming up?
I think it may be a little bit of both, you know, that there is this kind of tension there. We're certainly, I think, at an interesting inflection point, but I don't know that we can draw, you know, a nice linear line. I feel like there are some steps forward that were forward for a lot of people, but perhaps not forward for everybody, and then some steps back, you know. So I think this is one of the things that's at the heartbeat of the book, actually, is thinking really deeply about how we've gotten where we've gotten, the strategies that we've taken to get there, who it included, who it left behind, and how we might use those lessons to map a better, you know, more kind of polyvocal route forward.
We never in the book suggests, well, if not dignity, then what, right? That's not our question. We're not looking to replace dignity wholly. We're looking to reconceptualize, as we've said earlier, disrupt the concept of dignity as it's commonly understood, and then offer a path forward to about how dignity might be more inclusive, but also looking at the resources that exist within our own constitution and our own jurisprudential history to say we can go forward with our constitution in a way that is both more inclusive, that is more anti-racist. We are openly skeptical in the book as to whether this Supreme Court would do that, but it's not to say that it's an impossibility. There are routes forward.
Dr. Stephen Engel is a professor of politics at Bates College in Lewiston, Maine, where he teaches constitutional law and LGBTQ politics. Dr. Timothy Lyle is an assistant professor of English and cultural studies at Iona College in New Rochelle, New York. Their new book is called Disrupting Dignity: Rethinking Power and Progress in LGBTQ Lives. Still to come, you never know where you're going to find a hero. We'll explain next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Life is pretty good at putting barriers in your way when you're trying to simply live a smooth life. But according to commentator and storyteller Jerry Burns, if you look around enough, you'll also find it can plot a few heroes along the way, too.
Today, I'd like to talk about some unsung heroes. But before I do, I need to tell you about a guy I dated in high school. He jumped hurdles on the track team. Now, I thought that was amazing, along with the ripped legs that comes from running and jumping hurdles. But the thing was, I never watched him at a competition, or meet, or game, or whatever you call those events. Yep, band nerd over here. But I imagined him leaping and flying over hurdles like the Hulk hopping over high-rise buildings. Though I never saw my boyfriend jump a hurdle, I've seen animals do it. I can't believe how gracefully dogs get over them. I'm even more amazed when horses hurdle hurdles. But leaping over life hurdles isn't always so easy or graceful, and one of the times in my life when I faced many of them was when I got my PhD. A PhD process is sprinkled with hurdles. Some might argue that the process is spiked with them, evilly placed by sniggering faculty members testing to see how hard students will work for the golden apple of doctorhood. I mean, you really can't swing a hurdle without hitting an academic hurdle in a PhD program. And one of my biggest PhD hurdles occurred when I was getting ready to conduct research for my dissertation. You see, I had to translate data from one number-crunching platform to another, but the two platforms were not friends. I couldn't afford to purchase two pricey program manuals to see if there were existing instructions for making them communicate. I couldn't even do a browser search to find out the secret, since this was in the time just before Web 2.0. Now, it may sound like I'm old, but I'm not. Really. The spikiest hurdle of all, though, was that nobody at my school could help me. So thinking of little doggies and my high school boyfriend, I tried jumping the hurdle myself. Oh, I knocked it down a million times, but somehow, thanks to an odd combination of perseverance, creativity, and luck, I got those platforms to talk to one another. The process took a long time, but I figured it out and moved to the next hurdle. Statistics. Thanks to that experience, my patience for techno sleuthing is thin. Nowadays, while I don't mind the dopamine hit that comes when I find creative solutions to frustrating technical situations, I would rather get a pap smear. So in spring of 2020, when the pandemic forced my in-person college classes to go online, I had a lot of techno sleuthing to do. Now, despite my PhD experience, I do embrace technology and I love learning new platforms. But I didn't have the time to suss out every little techno mess in my transition to online teaching. But unlike my PhD experience, I wasn't on my own. People talk frequently about the heroes of the pandemic, all those amazing healthcare professionals, educators, scientists, and essential workers of the world. My appreciation for them knows no bounds. But today I want to spotlight an unsung group of pandemic heroes. IT professionals who burn midnight oil, computer screens, and calories to make it possible for people to connect during a very disconnected time. You find them in school districts, colleges, workplaces, on the other end of phone calls, and in live chats. They are the essential humans who answer desperate queries, fix broken connections, get the internet back up, conduct trainings, foster video conferencing, create tech courses, investigate why interfaces malfunction, research, write instructions, experiment, and troubleshoot, troubleshoot, troubleshoot. They also build up technological infrastructure, whatever that means. Though when I imagine it, I picture a fiber optic version of the neural pathways that crisscross the brain. In my mind, building technological infrastructure means that IT people are like nerdy Jackson Pollocks, furiously painting new pathways to meet the surge of technological need. Now, even if that conception is not exactly right, and I'm sure it's not, the takeaway here is that these unsung and often unthanked heroes have made it possible for education, work, and community to continue in spite of the pandemic. In live community theater, actors bow during curtain calls, but the curtain call doesn't stop there. After bowing, the cast points to the wings of the theater and to the catwalk above and behind the audience to acknowledge the crew. Those people who dress in black to invisibly move sets, shine lights, work sound, and make theater magic so that the actors can shine on stage. The unseen yet essential crew is the mortar, the foundation of any theatrical show. Just like theater tech crews, I believe that the unseen people who remove technological hurdles deserve a big hand too. They have been the mortar, the foundation of our ability to work, learn, play, meet new people, and remain connected with friends and family during the global pandemic. And so I applaud all the hardworking and patient tech people everywhere, including the one I married who recorded this essay, and all those I didn't marry who are making it possible for you to listen to it. You are unsung no more.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a writer living in New York's Hudson Valley. She teaches part-time at SUNY New Paltz in the Department of Communication and also works with the Story Crafters, a musical storytelling duo. You can learn more about them at storycrafters.com. Too much sitting down isn't a good thing, but not all sitting is created equal. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
If you're sitting, you might want to stand up for this one. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Yoa Sway, postdoctoral fellow at the University of Victoria, explains why.
Sitting. By some estimates, it's what we do for nearly 11 hours a day and is very likely what you're doing right now. While this number is high, it's hardly surprising, as our world is built for sitting. From our cars to our couches and everywhere in between, sitting is the posture of choice. Unfortunately, this sitting is also giving us diabetes, cancer, heart disease, hypertension, and is ultimately killing us sooner. Even if we are being physically active, excessive sitting still impacts our health. But is all sitting the same? To our bodies, yes. More sitting means more negative health consequences. But not all sitting may make us feel the same way. Our mood and our life satisfaction, together referred to as subjective well-being, is impacted not only by how much sitting we are doing, but by what we are doing when we are sitting. For example, sitting while enjoying good company or a delicious meal is likely to be a more pleasurable and rewarding experience than sitting in morning traffic. Generally, though, less sitting is always better. Even those who are regularly active demonstrate benefits to their subjective well-being from sitting less. So, if you can find time in your day to sit less, spending less time in front of a screen or in a car can boost both your health and your subjective well-being.
That was Yoa Sui of the University of Victoria. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.